loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, the eyes of the nation and the media have focused once again on Capitol Hill and the perpetual uncertainty about whether the U.S. government will remain open. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Next, in a segment we call Underreported America, we look at some of the less widely covered stories from around the country. A few days ago, a livery cab driver in New York City committed suicide in front of City Hall as a result of his inability to make a living under current taxi and livery regulations. We look at the issue of taxi drivers, their unions, the role of Uber lobbying, and its impact on the lives of drivers around the country. Then, today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts and prisons and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. But first, we take a look at the drama on Capitol Hill. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Welcome back, Dean.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Dean Baker, we were just looking at the news as we were about to go on here, and the stock market lost what appeared to be 100 points in the last 30 seconds or so. It finished down 1,000. We want to talk about what's going on in Capitol Hill, but let's first get your take as an economist, as a noted economist here in Washington, D.C. Why is this happening?
I don't think there's a good explanation for exactly why it's happening. I've joked about this, that everyone could attribute to whatever thing they don't like. The basic story I see is that the market is very high. We've had this long run-up, really pretty much 9 years straight. The market turned upward in March of 2009. It's been with some pauses had most of that time, in the last 2 years very rapidly. So the idea would just continue to go up really didn't make a lot of sense. So somewhere along the way, it was going to pause. Would it go down some? That was pretty much inevitable. So why did it do it now? I don't think there's any particularly good reason. A lot of people have pointed to the jobs report last Friday, which showed some very modest acceleration in wage growth. I don't think you could tell much of a story there, because really anyone following the data, and presumably if you're investing billions, you do follow the data. The acceleration they point to was year-over-year wage growth of 2.9%. There have been months in the past year and a half, where it was 2.8%. So it's a little hard for me to believe the markets are fine with 2.8%, but then they plummet because of 2.9. That really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Okay, well, we're going to keep following that, because volatility seems to be the order of the day. Dean Baker, let's talk about And I know you've been writing about this, and people can read your writings at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Let's talk about what's in the new government. It's not the shutdown deal, the deal to avoid the government shutdown. Talk about what seems to be happening. Clearly, immigration is not part of this package.
Yeah, so what you have is a situation where the Senate Democrats and Republicans came together on a deal where there's some additional spending on both the military and domestic side. To my view, it looks like a big concession on the Democrat side, because in the past they had linked them closely, and there's more for the military than there is for the domestic side. But in any case, the big issue that's most likely to tangle this is that there's not an agreement on immigration. So that doesn't seem to be in the Senate package. I personally don't have it, so I haven't looked exactly what's in the package. But that doesn't seem to be in the Senate package. Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House, the Democrats' leader, has insisted that there be some provision to help the children, the people that came here as children, undocumented people, that President Obama gave them deferred status. They wouldn't be deported. And Trump took that away from them, and they're now facing a March deadline. I think it's March 6th, if I remember correctly, where in principle they could be deported after that. So many of the Democrats have been insisting that any budget deal should resolve their situation. Trump has indicated that he'd only be willing to go along with something if it includes money for his wall. The Democrats, or at least the vast majority, are refusing to do that. It's I think by almost all accounts, very harebrained idea. So you have kind of a deadlock there, and it's not clear if the Democrats in the House are going to try to stop a budget resolution from going through. They probably have the votes to do that if no one votes for the bill, but it's not clear how they're going to treat it.
Dean, let me ask you also about the position of the Freedom Caucus. This is the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives. Earlier today, Speaker Paul Ryan said that he had the votes to pass this measure in the House. Just about an hour ago, he said he thinks he has the votes to pass the measure. But we also know that Tea Party members are objecting to two things. They're objecting to the sheer size of the addition to the national debt that this bill will cause. And they're also objecting to what amounts to a rescission of a cap on the debt ceiling. How do you think this is going to play out? And do conservatives have a real economic argument here?
Well, you know, at some point we can envision an economy getting overheated. At that point, the deficits can be a problem. Could we be there? I don't think we're there now. Could this push us there? Conceivably. The idea that we have to worry about the debt, that somehow the U.S. won't be able to pay its bills, that's basically silly. I mean, we're nowhere. That's kind of another planet. I always joke about that. That's like if you're driving west in New Jersey and someone goes, well, if you keep going, you're going to fall in the Pacific Ocean. I mean, it's a true statement, but, you know, less than, you know, 0.01% of the people driving west in New Jersey is going to end up in the Pacific Ocean. So it's really kind of a nutty. We're nowhere close to people not being willing to take the dollar, that we won't have credit, that sort of thing that they're talking about. But flipping that over again, you could argue, I don't think it's the case, but sure, we could get to a point where we're seeing too much demand in the economy, the deficits are too large. And in that case, I mean, that's hardly a crisis. Presumably what you do is look to cut back on spending. It doesn't happen overnight. Fed raises interest rates. I mean, there are things you do to slow the economy, which we've dealt with many, many, many times in the past. So I don't really think there's much of a story there. There's some story. It's basically not their story, but certainly deficits can at times be a problem.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, joined in studio here in Washington, D.C. by John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 a.m. in the Washington, D.C. area. We're joined from D.C. by Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, talking about the negotiations underway to avert another government shutdown and what that deal might look like. Immigration isn't part of the deal. Progressives within the Democratic Party are seething over that, what they consider to be betrayal. There's another element of the deal, at least what was passed in the Senate, the lifting of spending caps by about $300 billion over 2 years. But interestingly, and I'd say most importantly, $85 billion each year, $170 billion together for increased defense spending, Dean Baker. I mean, that increase is more than what Russia spends in the entire year on its military budget. Doesn't that simply have the effect of sort of draining the national treasury and then allows the so-called budget hawks to say, guess what? We're bankrupt. We have too big of a deficit. We have to cut spending for social programs.
Well, it's not draining the national treasury, but sure, the deficit hawks always yell that we have to cut social programs. I guess what I'd say is they're going to yell we have to cut social programs if we had a deficit of $1 trillion or if we had a deficit of $50 billion. I don't think there's a lot of relationship between what we actually spend or our limits on government spending and their desire to cut programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I don't think those two are related. In terms of, you know, is the military spending a good idea? Well, that's a good question. If it were a good idea, sure, then spend it. But again, I think that'd be a hard case to make. It's hard to know what threat we have that we think we're going to be dealing with by spending another $80 billion or $85 billion a year on the military. So that to my mind, is the question, though. It's not we have the money. I'll just put it that way.
Dean, I wanted to ask you a question about inflation. We've been hearing so much about inflation, whether it's from the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg or any number of other outlets, mostly over the last couple of days, saying that a fear of a return of inflation may be what's behind these stock market drops. But hasn't the problem really been deflation? Is there something that we're not seeing? Is the government overheated, and should we be worried about inflation?
Well, we aren't seeing deflation. I mean, there was some talk early on in the crisis, 2010, 2011, that we had to worry about deflation. I never took that very seriously. I didn't think that was going to happen, and it didn't happen. But the idea that we're seeing too much inflation, that it's going to get to be a problem, that's very, very hard to see. The Fed set a target some years ago of 2%. That was made there. They approved that. The Board of Governors approved that back in 2012, and they've been trying to get to the inflation rate up to 2%. And I should point out that's an average. So that means sometimes you'll be at 2.3, 2.4, 2.5, making up for times that you'll be below that. So our inflation is below their target, and arguably, and people at the Fed have acknowledged this, arguably the 2% target is lower than it really should be. So it's very, very hard to see how that's an issue. And when people have used that as a explanation for the fall in the stock market, that's basically easily refuted, because the government issues inflation indexed treasury bonds. So if you look at the gap between the bonds that aren't inflation indexed, so if I have a 10-year treasury bond and it's not indexed to inflation, currently the interest rate on that is something like 2.8%. I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but let's say it's 2.8%. Then if you look at the one that is indexed, it's something like 0.8%, which tells us that people are expecting an inflation rate of the difference, 2%, 2.8 minus 0.8, that gives you a 2% inflation rate. There's been very little movement in that. So the story that the market suddenly fell because people are fearful about inflation, well, we have a very good measure of what people expect inflation to be, and it's very little changed over the last week, 2 weeks, when the market was higher. So you're pretty hard-pressed to tell the story that that's the cause of the market plunge.
Dean Baker is our guest. We're talking about the fall of the stock market and also the negotiations going on at Capitol Hill to keep the government open. Dean, we only have about 2 minutes left. You took issue with Paul Krugman. He writes the op-ed for the New York Times Economist. In your blog, which people can find at cepr.net, Center for Economic and Policy Research, you say, "I have to disagree with Paul Krugman on his assessment of the current state of the economy. While I would agree with most of his comments about the state of the stock market and housing market and also the competence of the Trump administration, I think he is wrong in saying that we are at or near full employment." Talk about that. We have 1 minute left.
Yeah, this has been a hard issue. Yeah, I'm not dumping on Krugman. I know him and have a lot of respect for him, but I just think he's wrong on this. So you look at a 4.1% unemployment rate, and that's pretty good. That's better than what we've had almost, you know, any point in the last 50 years. So that looks pretty good. But by other measures, we still are below full employment. We have a lot of people who have dropped out of the labor force. These are prime age workers, 25 to 40, 54. These are not people that have retired. Krugman pointed to the quit rate. I pointed out that that's a somewhat inaccurate measure because the quit rate is higher. That's an indication people feel comfortable about the job market, in part because people are more likely to be in jobs where they quit frequently, like restaurants, as opposed to government employment, which has fallen as a share of total employment, and manufacturing, which has fallen as a share of total employment. So I was disagreeing. I think there's still room for the economy to expand and for more people to come into the labor market and get jobs. And that's a really important thing because those people need them, and it means increased bargaining power for other workers that already have jobs.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In this segment, which we call Underreported America, we look at some of the less widely covered stories from around the country. A few days ago, a livery driver in New York City committed suicide in front of City Hall, apparently as a result of his inability to make a living under current taxi and livery regulations. We look at those regulations and the advent of ride sharing. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Janice Earle. She's a business agent with the Washington, D.C. Taxi Cab Association, a part of Teamsters Local 922. And she's joined by the president and secretary of the D.C. Taxi Cab Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We looked at this article in the New York Post a few days ago about Douglas Shifter, who was a livery cab driver. And he committed suicide in front of City Hall. Before he did that, he posted a long open letter on Facebook in which he talked about his reasons for doing this. And his reasons were purely economic. He says that he worked 100 to 120 consecutive hours almost every week for the past 14 years, and he was still unable to make a living. Can you tell us what the situation is like for drivers here in Washington, D.C. and across the country?
My name is Goitom Absalab. I can follow up the question you just said. What happened to Douglas Schaefer is not an isolated incident. It does happen all over here, especially in Washington, D.C. We have close to 150,000 Uber, Lyft, Via, and other share riders, comparing to 7,000 to 6,000 licensed DC taxi drivers. So by comparison, it's like a tsunami. There's no way you can compete when there are too many Uber, Lyft, unregulated drivers to make a living with the cab drivers. So the cab drivers are restricted, and their economy is going, their income is going down the drain. So it's not an isolated incident. It's just a matter of time. The same thing can happen in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, it becomes an eye catcher when some tragedy happens.
Yes.
But cab driver has been telling this story over and over again.
Yeah. And Douglas Schaefer was not the only suicide. There were two other suicides recently from drivers. I want to read back and then bring Janice into the discussion a little bit more from his last Facebook post about why he was taking this dreadful, tragic, extreme action to take his own life. He said, when the industry started in 1981, I averaged 40 to 50 hours. I cannot survive any longer with working 120 hours. I am not a slave and I refuse to be one. There seems to be a strong bias by the mayor and governor in favor of Uber, a company that is a known liar, cheat, and thief. Janice, this is a big issue in New York because in the past, I mean, way back when, I drove a cab in the 1970s for a couple of years. There was a strong taxi drivers union. It was a real union. We worked off the meter. You didn't lease the cab. You didn't pay a penny to take it out. You got 50% of the meter. There were benefits. There was vacation time. All of that was undone. But as bad as what came next with the leasing system, Uber and the deregulation of ride sharing in New York City is in many ways a death sentence for those trying to make a living driving taxi. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. That is correct. And that is what the drivers here in Washington, D.C. are facing on a daily basis. And our local politicians and lawmakers, the director of the Department of For Hire Vehicles, are primarily responsible for the economic situation of the D.C. drivers.
Tell us a little bit, too, about what kind of competition you're facing when it comes to lobbying. We know, we see articles, of course, in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and elsewhere, that Uber and Lyft and some of these other companies are spending hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of dollars, in lobbying to try to get favorable regulations and favorable statutes enacted. How are you able to compete with the money that they're spending on lobbying? Is the union able to do its lobbying?
No, sir. Not to the degree, obviously, that Uber is in within our government here in D.C. There's really nothing that has kept them from, again, having their agenda pushed forward, and our drivers are suffering as a result. So we aren't able to compete with that kind of money. They're spending millions of dollars. As you know, D.C. is the lobbying capital. So these guys are really, really in a position where even though we have hundreds of drivers that are part of our union, the backing just doesn't compare in terms of the money that's making such a statement. And it's deregulating has been happening for the last couple of years. There are regulations in place for digital dispatch services such as Uber and Lyft. They're just not being enforced. And so, again, that comes down on DC drivers who are enforced upon. So there really isn't any voice for the drivers on that executive level, if you will.
In 2016, Uber, listen to these facts, Uber and Lyft combined spent more on lobbying than Amazon and Walmart combined.
Oh, my God.
And Microsoft as well. So Amazon, Walmart, and Microsoft were dwarfed by Uber and Lyft in terms of in terms of lobbying, and many of the lobbyists for Uber come from the Obama administration. And the whole point of lobbying is to carry out deregulation of existing standards for commercial driving. And I want to ask, after all is said and done, because many people might think, oh, well, Uber's more convenient. Uber gets there quickly. Uber's cheaper. But the Uber drivers themselves, after they get their bonus or whatever they do as an incentive, they can't make a living either. In other words, it's really just the owners who are living off of all of the labor, the underpaid, almost slave labor in many cases of all of these drivers. Go ahead, Janice.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Again, the money that Uber has put in to this industry, you can see that their efforts have been successful. Again, as far as the regulations go, deregulating, because they are there. And it's a matter of public safety as well. When you have almost 50,000 drivers in total on the streets at any given time, again, that's causing a crunch in terms of just operating and getting around. Accidents are increasing. And again, issues with individuals where you don't know really who's driving you around. Licensed operators, again, go through a vigorous process, and this is their livelihood. They're not just trying to make a quick buck. They don't blame the Uber drivers. Again, they know that the company is responsible, and as is the policymakers here in Washington, D.C.
I'm looking at an interview that was conducted on Democracy Now! A couple of days ago, or yesterday, I guess it was, with Bhairavi Desai, who is the executive director and co-founder of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. That's an organization that represents over 19,000 taxi drivers in New York City. And she paints a very bleak picture of the near-term future for New York's taxi drivers or livery drivers, black car drivers. She says that the Taxi Alliance just cannot win the deregulation race, and it's because Uber and Lyft spend so much money, not just on lobbying, but as you pointed out, on hiring people who were involved in regulation during the Obama administration and then having them fight for deregulation as paid lobbyists. What do you see as the future for taxi drivers here in Washington and elsewhere around the country?
Well, here in Washington, I think the first thing that has to be addressed, again, is the regulatory body that is responsible for enforcing and regulating for hire operations in Washington, D.C. There is a reason that Uber and Lyft are not subject to enforcement, that they're not paying the same fees that licensed drivers have to pay. And so I think one of the first things is to ask the question, why isn't the government doing the job it's supposed to in terms of regulating the for-hire industry as a whole, no matter who you work for?
You know, I want to ask another question, too, and that is Washington, of course, is a federal district. Everybody knows it's not a part of a state. And so there's far more federal oversight in Washington than elsewhere in the United States. Are you getting any support at all in Congress or from any other federal bodies?
No, sir. No, sir. Again, Uber knows who to go to, which is the D.C. Council. And at that level, they're getting everything they want done. And so we're not getting any support.
How about the health of the union? Brian and I are both former union members. I come from a long line of union members. I know Brian does as well. Tell us about the strength of your union. Are you able to increase your numbers in the face of this competition from Uber and Lyft, or is this damaging the union as well?
Yes, it's damaging the union. It's been extremely difficult. A lot of the newer drivers are, again, faced with learning about the industry in a way that doesn't even allow them to become a career driver. And for the drivers who are already career drivers, they're pushed out on every level. I mean, in terms of the regulations, like I say, the process of being licensed. So with them facing all these extra fees and the cost to them, they don't feel like they can even be members of the union, much less stay, you know, licensed for hire operators.
Yeah, that's what these bosses want to do, is they want to smash the unions, because if workers don't have a union, if you don't have organization, If you're just you against the company, you're more or less doomed.
Yeah.
You know, the Federal Trade Commission fined Uber $25 million for false advertising because they were offering these so-called bonuses to Uber drivers. Then Uber and Lyft used their lobbying might to exempt themselves from existing labor laws in 21 states. So if you get rid of labor laws and you get rid of unions, the worker, the person who actually does the thing that makes the company money, that person is driven into the ground. Talking about the kind of tragic suicide and, you know, Douglas Shifter, what he did, the tragedy of that, the hopelessness of his situation is such that he's speaking really and becoming a voice for, maybe unintentionally, but a voice for a large part of the workforce. I mean, this is a matter of life and death for working people and for labor and for the unions. And I think we all have to rally behind the taxi cab drivers union in whatever city we live in, including right here in Washington, D.C.
That's right. You know, Uber drivers, this is a point that Amy Goodman made on Democracy Now! Yesterday. When you engage an Uber driver or a Lyft driver, you really don't know anything about that person. You don't know, have any idea what kind of vetting process the person's gone through. I know that it's just a fingerprint check, which means practically nothing. But you don't know with whom you're getting into the car. You also don't know anything about the condition of that car. And so
let's have Janice have the last word about the union, what you're doing, how people can learn about the union.
Yes, sir. Well, we do have a website, of course, which is Teamsters 922, and any driver can go take a look anytime. It'll see the services we offer for licensed operators here in the District of Columbia. We will be having a drive coming up, a membership drive coming up shortly. And so what we can do, you know, if you guys are up for it, we can give you that information. So any of your listeners who are licensed operators who would like to join the union, come see us. And the more members we have, the louder the voice when we go to the D.C. Council, because, again, that's where this begins and ends for our drivers.
That's fantastic. We are joined from Washington by Janice Earle. She is a business agent with the Washington, D.C. Taxi Cab Association, a part of Teamsters Local 922. This is important. That's Teamsters Local 922. Google it. You can get some great information there. And she was also joined by the president and secretary of the D.C. Taxi Cab Association. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer of Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we are joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, John. Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you for joining us. Let's talk about a number. We have a number of stories in this week's segment that we want to cover. Let's start with the UK decision. The UK High Court blocks Lori Love's extradition over oppressive U.S. prison conditions. In a landmark decision, the United Kingdom's High Court of Justice quashed the extradition of activist and computer scientist Lori Love because it is possible prison conditions would result in his death if transferred to the United States to stand trial. Well, Paul Wright, if that's true for Lori Love, that would be true, I guess, for everyone. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's kind of hypocritical of the court because Abu Hamza, he was a Muslim, is a Muslim fundamentalist who gave anti-American sermons. He was extradited to the U.S. over those very objections, and he's severely disabled. He lost both hands. And I believe an eye in a bomb attack in Afghanistan when the U.S. was still supporting that war. And he was extradited to the U.S. over those very same objections. He's languishing in total solitary confinement in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. And a recent news article just documented his extreme health, mental and physical health deterioration that he has suffered there. But I think that just this ruling, just kind of, despite its selective nature, kind of illustrates what I think the rest of the world already knows, is that American prison conditions are barbaric and inhumane and don't comport with the norms of anything that purports to be a civilized society, especially when you consider the amounts of money that the United States spends on its prison system. You know, I think if you go to a third world country like Bangladesh or Venezuela and you ask the prison wardens, you know, why do you have bad conditions? They'll say, hey, we're poor countries, but we're doing the best we can with what we have. That is not the case here in the United States. We spend huge amounts of money literally to make people worse and with the deliberate goal of dehumanizing and brutalizing and maltreating them.
You know, I'm, Paul, like you and like Kevin, I'm in touch with a lot of federal prisoners. I get a lot of letters. I get emails from family members, and they talk a lot about prison conditions, that they're actually worsening. And they're worsening under this new Bureau of Prisons director. I'm talking about at the federal level. He's a retired three-star general who was in charge of the military's prison system, including the secret prisons where torture took place in Afghanistan. Do you attribute this decline in prison conditions, as bad as things were, they're getting worse, to this leadership, or is there some other reason why things are getting worse?
I think it's just been a steady decline and worsening of prison conditions, I think, for the last 30 years. I mean, I went to prison myself in 1987, and when I got out of prison in 2013 in Washington State, I was trying to be a little retrospective about it. Now, I think, was there a single thing that was better in 2003 than it was in 1987, and pretty much about the only thing that I could come up with was that thanks to the Americans with Disabilities Act, physically disabled prisoners had a little bit more access. But by every measurable means, levels of physical space, aka overcrowding, food, visitation, reading material, medical care, everything was much, much worse. And basically, it's been a steady decline that's gotten much worse since then. I think one of the things that we can attribute this to as well was President Clinton signing the Prison Litigation Reform Act into law in 1996. Prior to this law being signed, 43 out of 50 state prison systems and hundreds of jails were under court-ordered consent decrees and injunctions to provide minimal levels of humane care to the prisoners in their captivity. And this law basically allowed the government to go in and do away with all these court orders and consent decrees without improving the conditions. They were just able to go in and basically knock them all out. And since then, it's been very basically American prisoners have not recovered from the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and it's been a very difficult It's been a very difficult time to get any type of judicial relief. And frankly, the executive. And the only reason the judiciary was involved in prison reform to begin with was because of the total abject failure at every level by the executive and legislative branches. So I'd say that, you know, yes, to a certain extent it comes from the top, but it's been a long time coming. It's been pretty horrific, and to the extent we do have leadership, it's leadership about making things worse. So the fact that we have a war criminal in charge of the Bureau of Prisons now, yes, that's probably contributing to things, but it wasn't like it was any better before.
Yeah, it's a longer-term trend. Kevin, you've talked about in the past, and in your articles and in your podcast, you've talked in the past about the Prison Litigation Reform Act and how it's oppressive to prisoners who have legitimate legal complaints. They have to go through the internal complaint process first before they're allowed to file a suit. That process can take over a year, and when it expires, when they finally get through the process, and prisoners then have the right to file a suit, they're often transferred to other prisons, and then they have to start the whole process over again. And as a result, there are few lawsuits against wardens for prison conditions. What are you hearing?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think of your case. And your efforts, I think of CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling's attempt to challenge the way he was treated when he was trying to get treatment for his heart condition while he was incarcerated in Littleton. And I think, you know, the one thing I wanted to quickly raise specifically related to this UK decision, I really appreciate that Paul raised Abu Hamza, but specifically, I just want to make sure that people listening understood that this was a person who suffers from Asperger's syndrome and depression and has various medical issues. Not that Abu Hamza doesn't suffer from that. I think there's definitely some racism to the decision of the Royal Court. But, you know, they looked at the conditions in the U.S. and when the Bureau of Prisons made overtures to them that there would be psychologists available to take care of Laurie and that he could go through some medical treatment, they said, well, no, that's not what other experts have said. They've said that you actually don't staff psychologists for prisons, that you don't provide treatment, that in fact, sometimes you'll even have psychologists act as correctional guards, that they'll be put on duty and they're not actually engaged in providing medical care anymore.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. I can tell you from my own experience, even the chaplain acted as a security guard. The dentist frisked me one time during a shakedown. Everybody doubles as a security guard. One of the things I learned in the very beginning of my prison sentence was that everybody is a cop. It doesn't matter if he's the pastor or the dentist or the psychologist or the pharmacist. They're all cops first.
And importantly, I would add quickly that the whole suicide protocol, this putting him on suicide watch, they said that's not treatment. To put somebody in a smock, to stick them in a room, that would actually make it worse for a person like Lori Love to be put in those conditions and to be further isolated from family and have possessions removed from him. That would create detachment and he would be unable to actually go through a trial and function. That was also another thing, that being incarcerated in pretrial detention would contribute to your inability to defend yourself in a court of law. And I think that's really remarkable because what was happening to Chelsea Manning over the course of her incarceration, and that was a military prison,
mm-hmm.
but still, I mean, it's a recognition of the cruel and inhuman treatment of these people who are in pretrial confinement and don't get bail.
I can tell you exactly what happens when prisoners become suicidal, at least at the federal level. If a prisoner is suicidal, he's taken to the medical unit, he's stripped naked, and put into a room that has only a bed and a sink, nothing else. He's given a smock. It's made out of paper, so it's nothing that's going to keep you warm. One wall of this room is a giant window, and then other prisoners are paid 25 cents an hour to just sit there in a chair and stare at this guy and make sure he doesn't kill himself. There's no psychological assistance. There's no therapy. There's no medication. There's no nothing. And then when the medical office determines that this person is not suicidal anymore, he's either released back into the general population or, they say, for his own safety, sent to solitary confinement. There's no treatment for people who are suicidal.
Paul Wright, go ahead. Jump in.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not just, I think it's just not just the suicidal thing, but I think it's just the overall lack of mental health treatment. But I think that what makes this really even more horrific, I think, is the fact that depending on who's doing the counting and how it's being defined, that anywhere between 40 and 60% of the American prison and jail population is defined as seriously mentally ill. And by seriously mentally ill, we mean with, actual Axis 1 or Axis 2 diagnoses, by what psychiatrists would call serious issues, not just someone, hey, they've got a little issues or they got some quirks. And I think it's fair to say that in a lot of places, the state prisons and the local jails are the biggest mental health, de facto mental health facilities in a lot of states. And they're all characterized by that very lack of mental health care treatment and that. And what passes a lot of times for, I would say, not even treatment is this drugging prisoners up with out-of-date and outmoded psychiatric drugs and just basically drugging them with chemical straitjackets.
Oh,
and,
sure, I can tell you.
But in terms of actual, like, treatment or people are going to have a mental health care plan, it's quite the disgrace how the American criminal justice system treats its mentally ill people. And of course, I think, and not getting too far into the cause and effect thing, is how many people are in the criminal justice system because they're mentally ill, and we've seen this vast criminalization of mental illness and poverty and homelessness. And it's just a cycle that's really fed into the entire, you know, into the entire criminal justice system.
In fact, in the state of California, several of the less affluent counties, especially in northernmost California, have actually closed their state-funded mental health institutions. And when someone has a mental health crisis, they'll go directly from the hospital to the local jail because there's nowhere else to treat them. Well, they're not getting treated in the jail. They're just being housed in a cell, even though they haven't been convicted of any crime. When I was at FCI Loretto, the pharmacist told me one time that 85% of the prisoners were on some kind of psychotropic drug. A lot of it was antidepressant, of course, but a lot of it was given in what's called the zombie pill line. That's at 7 o'clock every night. All the prisoners who have severe mental illness, and in many cases, violent mental illness, go to the zombie pill line, get an injection or a pill, and then they're effectively zombies for the next 24 hours. And that's it. There's no other treatment. They just give you something that knocks you out, takes the energy out of you, so you're not violent toward the guards or other prisoners, and they just wait for you to finish your time and they can throw you out onto the street again. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, what I'd add to that is it was actually acknowledged by the high court that this is what would happen to a person who was extradited to the U.S. prison system. So the world knows that we're just drugging prisoners and we're not giving them medical treatment. And the other thing that I haven't raised here is that this individual was going to have to stand trial in three different districts. So then we can get into the other topic that I know that you have confronted, is how prisoners get shipped around through different prisons and
diesel
what that can
therapy.
Do to your mental state.
That's
what
right.
What that can do to your mental state.
Absolutely right. What Kevin's talking about is called diesel therapy in the federal system. If you have charges pending in different districts, like Lori Love would have had, or if you're viewed as a troublemaker, like I was, because I was writing a blog from prison, they'll put you in something called diesel therapy. And here's what that means. Let's say that you're in FCI Loretto, Pennsylvania, where I was. They decide you're a troublemaker, so they put you on a prison bus, and they send you to the U.S. Penitentiary at Canaan, Pennsylvania. You're at Canaan for anywhere from a week to 3 months in what's called transit status. From there, they drive you to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They put you on a Conair flight and you go to the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta and you're there for a week to 3 months. From there, you go to the Central Transportation Hub, the Bureau of Prisons Transportation Hub in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And then from there, you go to Denver or Yankton, South Dakota or Lompoc, California, all the time being in what's called transportation status. Because if you're in transportation status, you're not permanently assigned to a prison. And so you're not allowed access to a telephone, to a pen and paper, or to an email system. Your attorneys have no idea where you are. Your family has no idea where you are. And they can keep you in this status for as long as a year. A year where you have no access.
So you vanish. You disappear
into
the system.
You vanish in the system. And it's perfectly legal, and they use it as punishment.
That's the voice of John Kiriakou. He is the co-host of this show, Loud and Clear. He is a former prisoner for blowing the whistle on the CIA torture program following 9/11. We're also speaking from Chicago with Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News. Kevin, a 2014 report by the Treatment Advocacy Center said that, as we've been talking about, prisons and jails have become America's new, quote, asylums. 10 times more mentally ill people are now in jails and prisons, state psychiatric hospitals. In 2012, according to this study, approximately 356,268 inmates with severe mental illness were in prisons and jails, while about 35,000 severely ill patients were in state psychiatric hospitals. Now, these hospitals might not be great. We know the track record there. But nonetheless, 10 times more. This is America. This is what America has decided to do. And let's just talk about how we got here, say, compared to the 1960s, when a lot of those facilities, those mental health facilities, started getting closed down. And at the same time, the I don't know what you would call it, mass incarceration became a thing, a phenomena in America, where up until, I believe, 1976, the first 200 years that the United States existed as an entity, it took us 200 years to reach the million mark for the number of people in prison.
True.
And then 20 years more to reach the 2 million mark. But of course, this is tied in also with policy and how mentally ill people are treated by society. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, yeah, I just think of the kind of neoliberal transformation of urban centers that we've seen, and with the Democrats and Republicans, you know, fully responsible for what's gone on. Here in Chicago, we've seen Mayor Rahm Emanuel shut down mental health clinics, and that's not probably unique to Chicago. I'm sure other cities have seen that trend, and then all of those mentally ill people who need help, where do they go? Well, they become homeless. They become vagrants. They beg for money. Then they become trouble. They get rounded up by police. They get put in local prison facilities on the city or county level. They are get involved in drug dealing or drug using, and then they get incarcerated. There's no help for them, and that's a choice that our society is unfortunately making. The organization of wealth is being transferred to the top rather than taking care of people who are suffering in poverty.
Yeah, Paul Wright, there was historically, as this particular economic and social order evolved, there what was called the reserve army of the unemployed, a sector of the population that would remain perpetually unemployed or some parts of it unemployed, and that when capital needed labor, they could draw on that pool. That would have the effect of depressing wages overall, but really just being at the beck and call of capital. It now seems that we've evolved that system, or the system has evolved that system, to include as a major part of it the warehousing of people, again, either as low-wage workers or no-wage workers, i.e. slaves. But again, a real feature, at least, of American capitalism. Talk about that.
Well, I think it goes even farther than that, because I think that, yes, on the one hand, I think you can say the prison population has, or the prison population is basically the warehousing of that post-industrial reserve army of the unemployed. But I also think, too, that one of the things that we see, too, is it's also, I think it's also been a very effective counterinsurgency strategy. I think if you look back to the United States in the 1960s, when 300 American cities burned in urban rebellions, mostly led by young poor black men, I think that kind of the U.S. government response was, to use, I think, the counterinsurgency talk of the day, was that they were going to drain the ocean of the fish. And basically, I think for the last 10,000 years, it's fair to say that poor young men are the foot soldiers of regime change. And the United States, I think, has embarked upon not just disposing of the surplus population, but also caging and containing not just the 2.5 million people that are locked up, but let's talk about the 7 to 8 million people that are on probation, parole, or some form of prison and criminal justice supervision and surveillance and exile. And I think that's one of the things that, people underestimate or generally don't count that that parole and probation population, which is huge. I mean, you think about, 8 million people. I mean, that's the size of the New York City metro area. It's a vast number of people, and they're under total control of the state. They can be returned to prison or sent to prison, not for committing any new crime, but for violating technical terms of their release or their probation terms. And I think that one of the things this has done is given the United States a huge amount of social stability that has escaped, for example, you know, countries in Western Europe. And if it weren't for this level of mass incarceration, U.S. unemployment levels would have been in the double digits, just as they were in Western Europe starting in the 90s. And I think the flip side of it, too, about the American police state is I think, you know, we shouldn't just look at the 2.5 million people that are locked up in prison and the 8 million people that are under some form of correctional supervision, but it's also a vast jobs program. For the most part, for every two people that are locked up, there's one person drawing a paycheck to keep them locked up. And, you know, you now have millions of people that draw a paycheck from caging and surveilling large numbers of the American population. And it's like one of those things, okay, if they weren't being employed as prison guards or probation officers or GPS monitors and that, what would these people be doing for a job? And then the people that are being surveilled and caged, well, you know, that's that surplus population. That's that reserve army of the poor. And I think what's really unique is, you know, we've never seen anything in world history like this in terms of, you know, there's been police states before, whether it's Nazi Germany or the national security states in South America or whatever, but nothing on this level or scale. And that's one of the things I think is really, you know, from a historical viewpoint, I think it's very interesting. But on the other hand, you know, the other thing that also kind of puzzles me is why isn't this denounced as, you know, kind of the tyranny and the police state that it is?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I know I say that too much, but I mean, it's the truth. You're completely right, Paul. You know, there was an Intercept article a couple of days ago saying that a new report has found that economic class, is a more potent predictor of incarceration than race, although racism drives this whole issue. And they found that, for example, black male offenders received sentences on average 19.1% longer than similarly situated white male offenders between 2012 and 2016. There's absolutely no way to account for that other than racism.
Yeah, and I want to, before we bring Kevin back in, let's just look at some of the statistics again, as Paul was mentioning in the sort of hypothesis or thesis of his presentation, which is that it's not just warehousing the reserve army of the unemployed, the poor, but it's also a strategy of political containment of those sectors of the population that have been in the forefront of social progress, meaning the black community in particular. In 2014, African Americans constituted 2.3 million, or 34% of the total prison population. African Americans are incarcerated at more than five times the rate of whites. The imprisonment rate for African American women is twice that of white women. Now, when you think about drugs, African Americans and white people use drugs at a similar rate, but the imprisonment rate of African Americans for drug charges is about six times that of white people.
Six times.
So that's about enforcement, that's about policing, that's about sentencing. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, yeah, I think this is really critical to consider, because it seems like we talk about race, but we never include class in our consideration of racism. It just seems really obvious and clear that not only are we talking about black people facing severe oppression in this country, but we're really talking about poor black people. And coupled with this, I think it was the same outfit, the Poor People's Policy Project, or they also did a thing about how there had been a massive destruction of black wealth under President Barack Obama, that people, the drop in home ownership, the people who did have homes, the loss of value in what they had. And so you couple that with this, you know, showing the study that people who are poor African American face a greater likelihood of being incarcerated. You see just how the system could really control. You know, these are people who are experiencing widespread oppression. These are these communities want and would like to fight back, but having so many people that they know incarcerated creates such a burden and makes it so much more harder to challenge government policy.
Well, I think that one of the things that, I have to say, I'm not surprised about, study states that wealth is the clear indicator of who goes to prison. Because I think even people that that wholeheartedly believe that race is the main indicator of who goes to prison in this country, no one's claiming that wealthy Black or Hispanic people are being herded into prison in vast numbers.
Sure.
They aren't. You know, if you've got money, regardless of your race, you get pretty much, you get a lot of justice in this country. You get as much as you can afford.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think in some respects that, it's one of those things that the worst thing about the American criminal justice system is that it's very much a two-tier system where the rich get one system and the poor get another. And I think it's that very lopsided class-based nature that makes it so difficult to reform, because no one who's in a position of power or their friends or family members are directly affected by it. And I think one of the things that's more interesting is that, studies have shown that when laws are harshly applied and they're applied across the board, there's a bigger social impetus to change them. And the result is that either the laws are changed, they're repealed, or the effects are ameliorated. But what happens is when they're unequally applied, they tend to trundle on because, well, hey, it doesn't affect the people in the position.
The people
and I think one of the things to think about is, look at how the opioid epidemic.
15 seconds.
Just look at how the opioid epidemic, which largely affects white people, is being treated versus crack, which affected Black people. One gets treatment, one gets incarceration.
Indeed. Okay, that's the voice of Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News. Be sure to go to Prison Legal News website. We've also been joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.